Welcome to the Nitty Gritty Law School.
Thank you.
Which, by the way, does not exist. That's why it is on the announcement. You saw it in the brackets. But there's a story behind it. There was a fellow by the name of Bob Foster who used to go around recording a Roger Elvick. And he was selling the videotapes. And anyway, I had some problems with the court. It wasn't performing as advertised. So I eventually contacted Bob Foster. We're supposed to have audio here any second now. Is the audio working on that?
I haven't heard that.
Oh, that's
everybody
a problem.
Quiet. We'll just let Bill save his voice.
Of Roger Elvick. And Roger Elvick is the world's worst denter. He's probably one of the smartest people in the world. And when I would talk to him, or I'd listen to him on the tape, either way, whatever he had to say, it might have taken me a year or so. It might have taken me a year or so. And you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You got the volume going there? Okay.
I know, that's why I just thought so.
It would... It took me a year or so to catch up on this and figure out why it is that he was right. The interesting thing about Roger Elvick is no matter how indecipherable what he had to say was, he was never wrong. Eventually, I'd find it, like I say, it took me a year to figure out why, but it turned out he was always right. So over a period of time, reorganized what he had to say. Anyway, I sorted it out in my head and eventually organized it, and I had a lot of advice from a lot of people and so forth, as we all get. Eventually, this is what resulted. Well, Bob Foster had the Nitty Gritty Law School, and basically he sold videotapes of Roger. When he had a heart attack and passed on, his wife asked me if I would help out, and I said, well, sure, I'd be happy to, and so she had people call me. Over a period of time, I got a lot of vicarious experience, maybe 150 cases or so. I think I've pretty well got it honed down. Now, I want to tell you that we all started off using the statutory approach. We all believed the message that the courts were there to help us. And we've all seen the failures of the court system. So the Founding Fathers were quite shrewd. They understood the abuse of power. They understood. They'd seen the extreme with the king. And they put in some interesting features in our Constitution that are now starting to come out, starting to apply. And we're finding out that despite the fact that the government has taken over the school systems, and despite the fact that they have deleted the subject of civics from the curriculum, the information's still there. If you read the Constitution slowly and ponder over the words, you begin to realize it's quite a. Although it's in simple English, it's also quite in depth in how the government has been fenced in. By taking over the school system, the government has also changed the meanings of some words. They put a little twist on it so that we misinterpret what was the original intent of the Founding Fathers. So, anyway, the Constitution is not a living document. It has meaning, and it's there to protect us when the need arises. So, although that's technically wrong, it's really there to keep government constrained. So, I've sort of inherited the Nitty Gritty Law School name from Bob Foster, and every once in a while I bring it out. I used to have a website called Sovereign's Paradise because this is our concept, sovereignty, the sovereignty of the individual sovereignty. So I call this a joint venture between Nitty Gritty Law School and Sovereign's Paradise. So here we are. Now we have a little CD. I'd like to pass a paper around and get your addresses, because unfortunately I was planning to spend the whole week preparing for this and have them ready for you, but as it turns out couple of people got arrested. That sort of took precedence over preparation. And it's been a hard week last week, let me tell you. And but anyway, this CD, what I'm showing on the screen, you're going to get. Now, in the past, I've passed out a small CD. That small CD had something like 58 megabytes of information on it. This CD is bigger. It has 250,000 bytes on it. There's a lot of information. I've got several reference law books on it. I have the Constitution of the for the United States of America, analysis and interpretation. I have the United States Code, Title 18 of the United States Code, Title 28, and you know what? Title 26 is on there too. However, it didn't show up on this menu. That's what doing things in a hurry does, but it's hidden on there. There are a lot of there are hidden files on this thing. Let's see if we can see if I can show it to you. Here we go, and we'll go to the law notes right there. And in the subdirectory called law notes, we have you know what? Ah, I see the problem. We're on the C drive. Let's get out of that. And let's get to here.
This is also a seminar on how to use a computer.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, we're on the D drive, and we will go to the start here. It says programs, but what we really want is all files. And now we go to start. There you are. Now we go to the reference law books, and it's a little slower because it's on the CD. But I have Bouvier's Law Dictionary. We have an internet link to Webster's 1828 Dictionary, which is very valuable at times when you want to know what the original intent is. We have some excerpts from Cuffler's Common Law Pleadings. Okay. Specifically, I pulled out a few things relating to motions. Okay, this CD will continue to be developed. So, from time to time, I guess it's good to check back and see if I've updated it, because I intend to put the things that we need on it. On Cuffler, just to go there for a moment. We have chapters, a table of contents which shows everything in Cuffler's Common Law Pleadings. So if you want to know what's in the book, it's there. We have chapter 8, somebody had done, they put it on a PDF file. And then we have a bill of particulars, that's a motion for a bill of particulars. That means you want somebody to say exactly what the charges are, not just have a fluffy, cloudy thing. So this shows you how to demand a bill of particulars under the common law. Motions to strike under the common law, non-suits, directed verdicts, after the trial's over, how you ask for a new trial, or arrest of the judgment, repleaders. So I put some kind of some essential things. Those are all done by motion. Okay. also, we got Matthew Bender, Forms of Pleading and Practice. And let me tell you something, that is really one useful book. Even though you're in common law, you should go to Cuffler's. It's all statutorily oriented, okay? But it's a tremendous checklist. Remember that when you go into court, you want your paperwork to satisfy both requirements, the requirements of statutory law and the requirements of common law. The common law is the superior law, and whenever there's a conflict, of course, you go toward common law. But it's good to have everything, because remember, the people you're dealing with are somewhat ignorant of what we're doing. Attorneys are not trained in common law. You're on Mars as far as they're concerned. Okay? The judges go to special seminars, And the judges have to understand this just in case somebody comes along that knows about it. But it's so rare they forget. So if you go to Matthew Bender's books, they have two books that are really useful. One of them is called Forms of Pleading and Practice, and the other one is called Points and Authorities. And these two work hand in hand with each other. When you put together paper, you can lift the wording right out of it. It's great. They build these books based on cases that won. Okay? So it's really good. I highly recommend that series of books. There's also other good books too. A famous one is Witkin. You can go buy them in any legal bookstore, you know, but or they can order them. It's basically West Publishing, I think, is the one that publishes these things, or most of the legal books. And they're very expensive. You're better off going to your public library, which subscribes and keeps them up date. Not public library, but your law libraries. Most counties have a law library. Okay, so we also have the Constitution of the United States here. And I have Title 4, which relates to the flag. Title 18, which relates to the criminal procedure for a federal. Title 26, which is the Internal Revenue Code. And Title 28, which is the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, all these two books, Title 18 and Title 28, also have in them, at the end, the rules of court. So you're getting a double package there. Okay, it's built into that system. And then, of course, sometimes the Act of the Confederation and the Northwest Ordinance comes in handy. All right, then we have California, both constitutions. We have one person in here, by the way, that's never heard of common law like we've heard of it, okay? And so that person only knows statutory law and is very good at it, by the way. So I'm going to reiterate a little bit of what you already know. It's good to have a reminder anyway. Now I also have on here the entire California code. When you click on California, so you can look up any code that's in California on this CD.
Wow.
Pardon?
You got this all in 250 bags?
Yeah, and the capacity is 650 megs. So think what I can do. Believe me, I'm going to build this collection. I want to make this a useful tool for people like us.
Yeah.
Okay, now this is very crudely done by normal computer, you know, programming standards. Basically, what I did is I have the table of contents for each one. I just put the abbreviations, like BPC is Business and Professions Code, CV is the Civil Code, CCP is the Code of Civil Procedure. All right, so I figure you're probably smart enough to figure out what the abbreviations meant. And then the actual codes are listed here, okay? It gives you the range. Right down here, you have the range, okay? So you can see what they are. And again, it's got the entire list. So that, I hope, will be a useful tool.
Yeah.
See, I'm not a good speaker, so I'm trying to compensate by giving you this CD. Hope you get something that's worth your money. So here you are. And then finally, I have the Anti-Government Movement Guidebook. Now, well, you can laugh, but what this is a book written by judges for judges, and the whole purpose of it is to figure out how to get around our legal arguments. They are not concerned with, geez, maybe you're right. No, they're saying they actually spent money. The judges' organization actually spent money, hired consultants, and brought them in to figure out how to get around this. Yes, sir.
I got that about 2 or 3 years ago. So is this the updated version?
No, it's not. No, this is the old version. The interesting thing about it, if you read it, you will see, with the understanding that you all have of common law, you will see that these guys really don't get it either. They're as helpless as we are in when we start out. Okay, so when you go into court, it's not good enough to cite what the law is. You also have to explain it. Every paper I submit is pretty much a little course, a little education course in law for the judges. Not for the attorneys, just for the judges. I know the attorneys are a lost cause. They know I'm on Mars. They're totally convinced of it. And Over and over and over again, I hear attorneys saying to the judge, "Your Honor, I don't understand the paperwork. I don't understand what he's saying. I don't understand what he's doing." They say things like that. Judge understands, though. He went to the special seminars that they put on for judges. So he understands. Or if he doesn't understand, he quickly understands because somehow he seems to understand the paperwork better. But the attorneys are lost causes for some reason. I've never met a single attorney anywhere, anytime, in all the conversations I had with them. Not one has ever known what a court is. They practice in it, and yet they don't know what it is. And so I'm going to make a quick run through the basic principles. I figure the first hour we'd kind of spend on that, and that will help to give a perspective or remind you of the perspective here, what we're doing with this whole process. I do like to push the Devil and Daniel Webster right here, because that author had remarkable insight. I don't know where he learned what he learned or whatever, but this guy, when he wrote the story, he covered really two important points. He showed how a court is put together. He was correct in everything he did in this story relating to common law courts. And just the arguments that went on between the Devil and Daniel Webster. And very important, he tells you how to deal with a jury if you ever get in front of a jury. He had a jury that was picked, properly picked, by the way, by the plaintiff. Okay? That was the Devil. And every one of the jurors was an American, because that was what Daniel Webster demanded. And they had, but the Devil brought in people like Black Bart, you know, and a few others. And the jury foreman was something else, or the judge was something else. Anyway, it was an excellent story, and it's very entertaining. It's quite short, but boy, it sure illustrates the principles. So anyway, let's go to the law notes here. Quickly running through it, we're going to go deal basically with the foundation here, okay, for this first hour. This little saying by Cicero is really, really important. The most important thing that in this whole process, believe it or not, isn't in the books. The most important thing is you have got to have the right attitude. Believe me, if you have the wrong perspective, it's going to screw you over. You have to have the right attitude. If you have the right attitude, you will say the right things automatically. I have to tell people, the government is not your enemy. Okay, there are definitely people in there that are your enemy. And there's no question about it, you go into court, turn your back, you'll get stabbed. But you have to have the attitude that they're your friends. That doesn't mean you trust them. That just means you treat them like friends. You be nice to them. When you're not conducting business in the courtroom, you're nice to them. You go to the clerk's window, you're nice to them. Believe me, we have had some very, very profitable moments because of the fact that we were nice to people. They liked us and decided to help us behind the scenes. Okay? So, don't assume that just because somebody's on the other side of the counter that they are your enemy or they're out to make life hard for you. Even when the clerk tells me my paper is wrong and I know he's wrong, I do what he says as long as I don't sacrifice any of my rights. Okay? I'm not there to argue with him. I'm there to win. Are you there to fight or are you there to win? I'm there to win. And so I spend a lot of time. I go into a facility. I have a standard joke I tell everybody. A lot of you have heard it before, but I'll tell it again. I go into a facility. There's always new faces anyway. They never seem to tell each other this joke. So it's always fresh to them. But I always say, you know, as I'm dealing with a clerk, or like I went over to a jail to see a prisoner, and there's the sheriff there, you know, guarding the entrance to the jail. And I just friendly with him, and I say, "Hey, did you hear about that big fight over at the federal court? This guy fighting his parking ticket?" And, of course, they always say, "Well, no." You know, and of course, it's kind of unbelievable anyway. Somebody's fighting a parking ticket in federal court. I say, "Oh, yeah." He says, I said, "The guy went in there. And he argued and argued, and the judge finally got exasperated and said, "Well, Mr. So-and-so," he says, "didn't you see the sign?" And the guy says, "Yeah, Your Honor, I saw the sign. It said fine for parking." Let me tell you, that joke's short enough, targeted enough, they love it. Okay? Every one of them loves it. And that really is an icebreaker. And so, you go in, you talk to these people, be nice to them, you'll be amazed at how they'll accommodate you, and so forth. It took me 4 days to get, Ron Boggs was in earlier talking about a lawsuit that got filed, and it took me 4 days to get that sucker filed, because they never heard of a counterclaim. So I accommodated, I called, okay, you want a complaint, I'll put a complaint on it. Remember, on your papers, titles do not count. What counts is the substance. You can call something a complaint and it's actually a habeas corpus. Okay? So it doesn't matter what you call it. What does matter is the actual text in your action, whatever it is. So, sure, I had it all laid out properly, and then suddenly they didn't like this, they didn't like that, and I knew the guy wasn't hassling me. I knew he was just ignorant. You know, how do you educate somebody when they think you don't know? So I accommodated it, and we eventually got, and I would, and he says, "Well, you can't have such and such on there." So I take a black ink and I black it out, you know, redact. I did lots of redacting on it, okay? As long as the basic thing didn't get changed, we were fine. So now it's in. We'll see where it goes. In the meantime, we're suing judges and DAs, and public defenders are getting sued too. Got 28 defendants, by the way. We made a project out of them. Normally, I only target one defendant, but I could see that we had to make an impact somewhere. Besides, it costs $300 per person in L.A., county court to file an answer to an action. So, the county needs some money. So I'm helping them. Okay. So, it's important to speak the right language. Remember, in America, we speak three languages, right? We got the language of the street, which changes from day to day, block to block, town to town. Okay, very unstable language. But the street language has a lot of slang in it and so forth. That's a whole separate language. You know, when you see something that's really cool happening, you say, "Man, that's really hot." Well, that doesn't work in formal English, but it works with slang. Okay, in we have formal English, that's the second language, and the third language is the language spoken in the courtroom. The courtroom English is very, very stable, and it will it has, you know, it might take 200-300 years for a word to change its meaning. So courtroom English is a good reference, good thing to use when you go to court. And words do not mean in the courtroom necessarily what they mean in business English or formal English. So you have to study it as if it were a separate language. You know, it's good to be trilingual in America if you can speak all three English languages that are spoken here. And when in doubt, speak legal English. And legal English, you know, I mean, and we have dictionaries that explain legal English. But they're not called dictionaries. I think one of the dictionaries that is available in the library is called Words and Phrases. Okay, what is there, about 100 volumes in that little dictionary? Or maybe it's 50 volumes, whatever it is. It's a lot of books. And they spend several pages just explaining what the word T-O-2 means. You know? But there's been battles on that. And so if you want to really know English, you read those books. If you just want a running start at it, take the Constitution, start with the first word, pretend you never saw the language before, and every time you meet a word for the first time in that context, look it up in that dictionary and see what it means. You might be surprised. That's how I learned, by the way, to speak some of the words. Okay, anyway, next question is, people or citizen, which one are you? Okay, the people own the government owns the citizens. That's the basic relationship. And this is based on the preamble as far as what the relationship is between people. See, I cannot tell you what the word people means. Okay, if you ask me to define people, I don't know. But what I do know is that I'm one of them, and according to the preamble defines, it doesn't say what people are, it only says where they're from and what their relationship is to the government. See, if you look at the preamble, I'll pop down there to it. It says, "We the people of the United States." Okay, that's who and where from, and our purpose in order to form more perfect union, etc. And and who the beneficiary is. It's ourselves and our posterity. All the elements of a trust, by the way. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for whom? The United States of America. That's the trustee. Okay, we are the trustors and we are the beneficiaries, and the United States of America is the trustee. So, okay, then we have here's the key words right here. Ordain and establish. Okay, to ordain means to make law, to authorize. Grab a seat, sit down anywhere. And to establish means we actually created the Constitution. So it's by our authority as people that we create, that this thing comes into existence and establish it. We are the ones that created it. And who do we do it for? For them. So if I make a bowl, does the bowl suddenly own me? No. See? So if I authorize the government to exist, if I create a business, if I'm the owner of a small business, does the business suddenly own me? No. I can step in. I may decide to hire a manager and be the janitor. And I may voluntarily take instructions from my manager. But anytime I want, I can walk back in and take over because I'm the owner. And so the people, we can, for some purposes, be a citizen, and for other purposes, not a citizen. Just like for some purposes, I could be a janitor or not be a janitor in my own company. So, okay, so that basically defines the relationship between the people and the citizens. I mean, and government. Now, understand one thing. I am accusing myself of being one of the people. No one else is accusing me of that. If somebody comes along to me and says, "I don't think you're one of the people. Prove you're one of the people." No, that's not how it works, fellas. It is up to the accuser to prove I'm not one of the people. Okay? Burden is on them. I can make any claim I want on myself, but it's up to them if they don't want to believe it. They got to come up with the evidence that I'm not. Okay? That's a fundamental relationship that we have here. Okay, now we go down to citizens. A citizen of the United States operates on different terms. For one thing, it's the 14th Amendment right here. Amendment 14 inverts the relationship. Basically, I don't know what I did with it. But anyway, in the 14th Amendment, basically it says that if you are born or naturalized in the United States and if you are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, then and only then are you a citizen of the United States. Okay? So if you're subject to the jurisdiction but not born or naturalized, then you're not a citizen. Or if you're born or naturalized but not subject, you're not a citizen. Okay? So if you're born here but you're one of the people, then you're not subject. So therefore, you're not a citizen. Now, what they do in school, they don't teach us the words of freedom. They only teach us the words that bind us. And so they teach us that you should be a good citizen. They displace the subject of civics. Civics, by the way, means the study of personal rights. They displaced that. They brought in a new course, which they chose to continue to put under the shadow of civics, the name. But it was actually American government. It was back in around 1950 that they got honest and started calling the classes American government or social studies, I think was another. So they teach you to be good citizens, and they say you have duties, which is true. All citizens have duties to their masters, okay, to the government. When they passed these 13th, 14th Amendments, what they were doing, they said they were freeing the slaves, but that's not true. What they were doing is they were transferring the slaves out of private ownership into public ownership. And they did that for the black people, But then, because of the wording and the fogginess that comes with the modern education, they then transferred, they're trying to transfer the white people also into slavery. See, the public slavery. And slavery I'm defining as not being able to do what you want.